Today, we get familiar with a globe-trotting magazine enjoying a second golden age under the stewardship of a Parisian art director. Plus, our very own Marco Sippi brings us a report from IndieCon, one of our favourite independent magazine festivals that wrapped up last week in Hamburg. All that ahead of us today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Holiday is a travel magazine originally published in the US between 1946 and 1977, taking literary giants such as Graham Greene, Joan Didion and Truman Capote and setting them loose in exotic destinations. It enjoyed over a million subscribers at its peak. Now, after a 37-year hiatus, it's been revived by Parisian art director Frank Durand. To find out more, Monocle's Fernando Pacheco spoke to the magazine's editor-in-chief, Marc Bougeot.
The magazine was actually created in the 50s in the United States. It was a huge magazine at the time. It was very big. It sold millions of copies. Basically, the idea of the magazine has always been the same. Traveling in the best conditions possible. Holiday at its origins would send writers all around the world to do long features. They would send the best photographers with them, and you would have like small novels almost by Hemingway, by Colette, by Joan Didion. All the best writers would go on their travels for Holiday and come back with a story. We haven't changed the ADN of the magazine. In the new version of Holiday, we also sent writers all around the world. We also sent the best photographers possible, or at least the one we like, all around the world. And we try to do a travel magazine that is both informative, intellectually interesting, and beautiful. That's important.
And you have a new house as well. It's in France. I mean, how much of the DNA of the magazine is French these days?
It's a mix. The magazine was created in the States. It's in English. It's published in English, even nowadays. So it's a bit of both. I think you can feel that we are French by the way we choose our writers, probably. Also by a kind of aesthetic we look for. The artistic director of the magazine is obviously French, and he likes French elegance. I mean, it's sometimes difficult to define French elegance, but it's understated luxury, I would say. So you can feel by reading the magazine probably that we are French, because we don't try to hide it. On the contrary, we are very proud to be French. And choosing the writers for the magazine, we tend to go to French writers because they are easier to access, and also because we think it's interesting to send foreigners writers to different countries, that they come back with a story that is maybe different to the one a local writer would write. So we try and keep our French DNA, even though the magazine was originally created in the States.
I agree. And also, I want to talk to you about the business model of Holiday. I mean, clearly you do have a very healthy selection of ads in the title. But, you know, tell us a bit more, because, you know, you also have a shop that you sell on your website. You have a cafe as well in Paris. Yeah. Tell us a bit more about this other branches of Holiday.
Yeah, the idea is to create, behind the magazine, to create a brand that would be Holiday. So, you know, we put a lot of money on the production of the magazine, shooting the best paper, the best photographers, writers. It costs money, obviously. Advertising allows us to not to lose too much money. We try and keep it reasonable in terms of loss of money. The shop and the coffee is also a way for us to make money, to develop the brand. You know, the magazine is like the window shop for the brand. I mean, it was created first, and it has given the whole identity of the brand Holiday. I mean, you can find something, some very common directions between the magazine, the shop, and also the cafe. It's all the same, basically. Magazine gave the first direction, and everything follows. And obviously, when you do a cafe, when you do a shop, a fashion line, you try and make it profitable in terms of money. That's what we are doing. The magazine, I would say, even the most profitable entity of the brand. The rest probably in the long term as a more makes more of a sense financially. But we need the magazine to be able to do the rest. Otherwise, we are just like any other fashion brand. We like the fact that the whole identity of Holiday is based on an intellectual aesthetic object that is the magazine above all.
Absolutely. And I have to say, you do sell an incredible yellow sweatshirt as well. I'm tempted myself. Another question is going to say, cool, I have the latest issue in front of me, the spring summer issue about California. Before you tell us what's going to be the next theme of the next issue, how was it to make an edition about California? How involved are you in terms of choosing where the magazine is heading next?
Yeah, it's all a discussion with Frank, the artistic director of the magazine. I mean, it all comes from a feeling, a vintage picture that we might see, an old article in an old holiday that we might find interesting. So we speak about it, we ch sometimes change ideas. But California was pretty obvious. I mean, it has been obvious almost from the beginning. We kept waited a bit before going there because I think people were really eager to see us going there. People were waiting for that. So it put a bit on pressure on us. So we wanted to do it well, and we wanted to tell off the California that people don't usually talk about. That was the main point. I mean, California is so big, so rich in terms of aesthetic, of culture, of history. There's so many things to tell. So we tried and surprised people. That was probably the main thing about that issue. Not tell people the California they already know about. The next issue will be talking about a cold country, Denmark. It's coming out at the end of September. With Denmark is obviously different to California. California, you have to edit the subject. You have to find an angle to speak about the California that people don't know about. Denmark, you are more the discovery of the country.
If you're listening to the programme, you're probably someone for whom independent magazines provide a welcome break in your day. But spare a thought for the people who put them together. Long hours spent hashing out ideas in a small team can take its toll. This is perhaps one reason why IndieCon, an annual conference that takes some of the brightest talents in independent magazine publishing and brings them together to exchange ideas and publications, is so hotly anticipated among the industry's movers and shakers. This year's instalment wrapped up last weekend in Hamburg, and Monocle's Marco Sippi was there for us. And now he's here in Studio One.
Exactly.
Me.
Hello. Hello, Tom. After last weekend, it's easy to believe in the future of print. It was such a fascinating event. There was so much excitement and passion at this villa where we caught up at IndieCon in Hamburg. Many interesting discussions. I think it's always healthy for these people working with these titles as well to catch up with people who are facing same issues. That's when you can discuss what inspires you, what your problems are, and you can maybe even share some tips as well and offer support. I've prepared a rundown of highlights from that event. Obviously, I spoke to loads of people, and I think there were two titles that in particular were both very relevant for this time, and it's fascinating how they both actually thought about their job the same way. They both had decided that they wouldn't be running indefinitely. There was a set number of editions of the magazine that would come out, and this way they would work as a time capsule of sorts for the future generations even, time capsules that explain the atmosphere and discussion topics of this decade. So the first publication I'm talking about over here is called Micron Journal. It's a 6-issue publication exploring the circulation of people, goods, information and even fauna and flora, the founding team says. And obviously what prompted them to launch this magazine was a discussion over migration of people. I caught up with two members of the founding team, Isabel Seifert and Justine Tribillon, and this is what they had to say.
So the idea behind this project was really to re-explore that concept of migration. So it was at the time we started this project during at the height of what was called, what is still called, the migrant crisis. And we really wanted to explore that issue of migration and the character of the migrant in a new way, in a fresh way. So really disconnected from the political discourse and re-explore it with a genuine multidisciplinary approach.
So you were talking about the content over there, and then the looks of the magazine are really impressive. That was obviously something that you had a clear vision of as well.
Yeah, and that's also why we started working really early on together, the editorial and the design team, to make the concept a decision together for the visual narrative that we wanted to achieve with this, not to be only a very one-sided narrative, but like multi-layered publication.
How did you define that visual narrative you're talking about?
We had this idea of some movement. We kind of fell into this idea set of having the Atlas as our kind of base, and we went into research for this, and that's also why we established early on we wanted this layer of infographics, maps, contextualizing pieces, intriguing photography to really tell stories and articles from various sites and point of views.
I think migrant journal is one of the greatest examples of how to embrace print and what a difference having a physical object makes compared to something that could be online.
Yes, and for us, I mean, the print medium was evident from the beginning. I mean, we really wanted to work with the print medium. I mean, we all love books, we all love ink, we all love paper in this project. And also in the longer term, we did consider, for instance, doing an online magazine, an online version of the magazine even. But for us, we really wanted to have that long-term relationship with publishing and with this publication. And we really wanted to already think about the legacy of Migrant Journal and already think that in 5, 10, 50, 100 years, you would still be able to find it and read it, and it would still be probably still be relevant to you.
Insights from the Migrant Journal team there, Marcus. Fascinating chats. You were a busy man, weren't you? What are we going to talk about next?
Well, the other magazine I was referring to earlier that also has decided that it's going to have a limited lifespan and is going to document this decade and what people are talking about. Well, you're looking at the cover. It says sex.
It's a sex special.
Which is called Kosovo 2.0.
What drew you to this, may I ask, Marcus?
That was the most talked about issue of the magazine, actually,
so far. Is this How to Date a Well-Built Balkan Man section?
It's a shame that I actually spoke to the founder of that magazine, editor-in-chief, Besa Lucia, and she said that when they launched that sex issue of that magazine, they got into quite a lot of trouble for that, and that has kind of given them some sort of a label. People think it's a sex magazine, even though the idea of the publication when it was released some years ago was to give a voice to the younger generation of Kosovo and should I say also a more liberal generation. And indeed, like Migrant Journal, it documents very well the mood and atmosphere in that part of the world. Let's hear more from the editor-in-chief of Kosovo 2.0, Besa Luci.
I think when we started out with the magazine, we were really focused also on people stories and individual experiences, because for a post-war country and a country undergoing the state building processes and kind of shaping who you want to be, a lot of the mainstream public discourse was very much kind of either hijacked or dominated by the political leaders and political establishment, and the mainstream media in a lot of ways also perpetuated that through their coverage. And for us, there was a huge gap in terms of the issues and the topics that were being discussed, and we felt that also if you want to talk about these kind of like even like political processes or social injustice or whatnot, you also have to talk about what is happening to like people on a day-to-day basis. So at the beginning we were really focused on finding experiences and stories of people that can stand for something bigger as well.
Was it also about giving a voice to a generation that had not been so visible at that stage?
Yes, definitely, because I mean Kosovo has a very, very young generation, actually the youngest in Europe, so like 60% of the population is under the age of 30. But those voices are, at that time, they were silent in a lot of ways, and to some extent me and also the team that we were behind, we saw ourselves as belonging to that group of people. Like, so, and I think it's changed over the years, and especially where we are now. But at that point, that was one of the ideas, and I really feel like we helped push that notion that. I mean, you cannot have the political class talk on the name of the youth and not know what the youth stands for. So that's kind of what the idea that we started with initially as well.
And what you did actually had quite an impact. I think most notably what you talked about a moment ago here at Indicon, your issue number 4, sex issue, actually had an impact. I'll let you explain.
Well, yes, the sex issue focused on LGBT rights, so the LGBT community in Kosovo and the rest of the Western Balkans and gender identity. And when we launched it, so there was a backlash, so we had groups of particularly men who attacked us at the launch event of the magazine, because in a lot of ways it was really the first time that somebody was talking genuinely and openly about the LGBT community, and also just saying like, yes, there is an LGBT community here, but now we have to also move forward and see what does it mean to be a gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual person, and how difficult it is, because it's in a lot of ways an extremely homophobic and patriarchal society. So it goes back to what I was talking about earlier, so like challenging that idea that not one entity can decide what it means to be an Albanian or to be a Kosovar, or however you want to define it. So yeah, and then but in the even though we faced this attack and it was extremely difficult for us as a team, the good thing that came out of it is that I mean, we really believe that it helped break the culture of silence, and the discussion has really changed and come a long way since that year to today.
And I guess we're talking about the building of a national identity, and you have to ask difficult questions when you are going through that process. How do you see the impact Kosovo 2.0 has had so far?
Yes, it is definitely contributing to that discussion and debate of national identity, and I think we have a lead in a way in this regard, because we're constantly doing that with our content. We very much believe that as a publication we stand behind this. We believe in the Kosovo and Kosovo identity, but that is something that does not exist by itself per se. It's something that we all contribute to. So I think through our content we also raise a lot of questions of, what do we want to be a Kosovar to mean? Do we want it to be a society that is inclusive, or you know, like, so we, so that's why, for example, we have a huge focus on human rights issues, and I think we do have an impact in that regard, because whether when we're talking about sports or human rights, we're constantly challenging that discussion and that idea.
So that was Beza Luzzi, the editor-in-chief of Kosovo 2.0.
Marcus, let's turn next to Hello, Mr. magazine.
Hello, Mr. has been mentioned.
Tell us about this, kind of in the world of fashion.
Hello, Mr. has been mentioned in this program before. Hello, Mr. says it's about men who date men, and the founder of that magazine, Ryan Fitzgibbon, was in Hamburg as well. If you looked at the first editions of the magazine, what you're looking at now is the brand new edition number 9, but if you would have looked at the first editions of that mag, you probably would have classified it pretty much as a harmless lifestyle magazine. But now, after Orlando attacks and Trump's presidency, for example, it's become quite clear that a magazine like this will have to stand up for the gay community and also for the minorities within that community, and that's what I talked about with Ryan Fitzgibbon, the editor-in-chief of that magazine, when we caught up in Hamburg.
Really want to give back what I've learned in these last 5 years, and so I've launched a residency as part of this new change in the issue and the content that we create, to start giving over the microphone to other people in the community who aren't often enough heard from. And so we have a new zine inside of every issue of Hello Mister that comes from new voices within the LGBTQ community, outside of what we've primarily focus on as our core, which is men who date men. Now we have a platform and a space within a gendered magazine called Hello Mister to talk about other issues and hear from people that traditionally we haven't. So that's one example of sort of how we're moving.
And what kind of issues and what kind of people are speaking on those pages, by the way?
So in our first residency, we'll be doing one every 6 months, and our first residents came on as our prototype, so call it issue 0, if you will. And they are 2 queer Latinx people from Texas, and they are focusing on and discovering queer stories in unexpected corners of the U.S. and Mexico. So we have gender nonconformist day in the life of in Columbus, Ohio, and what it feels like to be queer and gender free in a city that's like that. And we have a lot of content within just the 16 pages. I think it packs quite a big punch with new and unexpected sort of angles that aren't coming from the coasts or coming from the large cities.
Was it obvious for you from the very early stages that you wanted to have an actual print product instead of creating something online?
Absolutely. Print for Hello Mister is all about visibility. There hadn't been a publication in 2011 when I had started the magazine prior to But that was on shelves, that was extremely relatable or not glossy in its mainstreamness. I think a lot of our larger titles for the LGBT community fit a very certain type of mold, and they've slowly been innovating over the last few years. But when I launched in 2012, there was a lot of the sameness. And so print for me was always about shaking up the newsstand for gay men. And now continuing in print, it becomes a badge, a thing that people sort of embody and have on their coffee tables proudly, because it says something about who they value as a gay man that has really started to change the definition for, I think, a larger society.
Fascinating to hear, Marcus, from Ryan Fitzgibbon there in conversation with you about Hello Mister, as you said, the handsome number 9 edition out now, one imagines. I just wonder, when you walk around IndieCon, were there sort of prevailing narratives? Was it very much a thing where there were themes that people kept seeming to come back to? Or did everyone, as perhaps you might expect from journalists and those sorts, did everyone have a very much a different story to tell?
I think there was a lot of variation over there. I think it was a very eclectic collection of different magazine titles I came across in Hamburg. What's interesting is that many magazines seem to set themselves some kind of a manifesto or a goal, but not always. And actually, I was just going to mention that Sunday was the most exciting day, I thought. That was the Indie Mag Day that was open for public, and you had even more magazine titles over there then introducing themselves and obviously selling copies of the magazine. And when I was walking around over there, I noticed there was a strong design focus in many of those magazines. And what you are looking at now, Brasilia magazine, is a great example of that. That was actually shortlisted recently at the Stack Awards here in London. And what's also delighting me a lot is that there was a lot of young people working with these magazines. And for example, the team behind Brasilia magazine is a young team. They are from Hanover. It's published actually by the Hochschule of Hanover. I know you may be asking about the name. Well, one of the team members told me that where they have the office of Brasilia, it's placed at the Expo Plaza that's left over of Expo 2000 that took place in Hanover. And the whole construction feels so artificial that it has always reminded them of the Brazilian capital that was just placed somewhere. So that's the story behind the name. But anyway, let's hear more from one of the members behind that impressive title. This is Arne Meyer, graphic designer and editor for this magazine.
It's a magazine which is powered by the university, so everyone is contributing. The guys are professors and students and friends of them, so it's like a big circle of people, and they contribute to the magazine, and that I think that makes the character of the magazine. So it's kind of a family thing and a network thing, and every issue is totally different in its content, but the people who make it are always kind of the same thinking, and they all of them work at the university.
So what kind of design goals do you have? I know that you kind of look at things from the design perspective. What do you want to create?
Yeah, we always try to support the content of the articles, so we don't do graphic porn or something. We just try to design it as simple as possible but as supportive as possible for the actual content. So we try to use the right paper to support. Maybe there is an article about the red light districts in the Philippines, and that we used a red color for the red light, which is actually reflected by the shiny paper. So that's how we work. So we try to take the content, to read it, to examine it, and then transform it into design.
The brilliant Brasilia magazine coming to life at the IndieCon in Hamburg. Marcus, another excellent interview. You were busy, weren't you? Did you get a bit tired going through all of those Messehalle?
You know what? They had a fridge over there at this villa where we caught up, and the fridge was full of refreshments.
You do surprise me, Marcus. Time for one more, perhaps?
Time for one more. There was one person who actually didn't have a title of her own. I'm talking about Megan Le Mesurier, who is from Sydney University, and she focuses on indie magazines. We caught up with her as well, briefly, and she explains why it seems that the indie publishing scene is flourishing.
I think there is a real need for people to slow down and focus, and I think part of the reason indie magazines in print are flourishing now, and increasingly flourishing, is because we live in such a fast media environment. And I think it's interesting that the younger people, the digital natives, who everybody assumed would give up on print completely, are the ones who are becoming really passionate about it. And I think part of it is they find it helps them slow down and focus.
And the discourse we've been facing for so long now is that things are going digital and print is gradually dying. That is something you disagree with totally.
Yeah, I disagree completely. Of course we're going digital. It's just I don't think it's an either or. I think technology and the digital has changed so incredibly fast over the last 20 years. People tend towards the apocalyptic, you know, they want to make these pronouncements, and I've been around for long enough to see them be quite wrong. Now, in the mainstream media, in terms of magazines and certainly in terms of newspapers, print is under threat, and it's only the really clever people who can make print work. But indie magazines are different because they're not driven by commercial imperatives, so they can experiment and make their alternatives and make their beautiful objects.
What do you think mainstream media and mainstream magazines should or could learn from indie titles?
To be a bit more inventive about their content. I think what the indies do when you spend time in their world, which I have been collecting them for the past 10 years, is that when you see, say for example, a mainstream travel magazine compared to the indie travel magazines, all you see is commercially driven, predictable, cliché travel journalism. And I think eventually, they know most of the mainstream magazine sales are in decline, and I think this could be an opportunity for mainstream magazines to actually stop being so conservative. I've used to work in the industry. It tends towards conservatism. And especially when things are going badly, they tend to become even more conservative when they should be doing the opposite.
And now, after all those titles you have seen when you've been conducting your research, have you ever started wondering what it would be like to launch your own title?
I have a feeling that that's partly why I'm so into this, is that when I worked in mainstream magazines, which is way back in the 80s and 90s, we were always, you know, designer friends and I were always dreaming of making our own magazine. I just could never really find the time or afford to do it, and I'm a bit of a nerd, so I ended up going back to becoming an academic. Yeah, I'd love to, but I don't know what it'll be. Maybe it's when I retire and I make a magazine, beautiful magazine for old people.
Marcus, you'd be squarely in that demographic, wouldn't you, of course?
Not yet. Give me a few years. A
couple.
Maybe. What's your magazine idea for the future?
A
magazine
like
on resting.
You joke.
I know you too well.
I think that's a good idea. The only trouble is quite a supine audience.
I know.
Enthusiasts of resting are not going to be out and about hitting the newsstand, are they?
I mean, like when you have that magazine in your hand and you lie down, you can read. You need short articles, about two, like,
good
you
point.
Know, articles that take about 2 minutes to read before you fall asleep.
They could just read your column from the latest newspaper, Marcus. They'll be out in a moment. Marcus Hippie, he trod the halls of Hamburg at IndieCon. Marcus, thanks for being with us on The Stack. And that's it for this week's programme. Thanks to our producers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Reese Sheridan, and our editors, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Any comments or queries are welcome. Drop a note to Fernando. He's on fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next week. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you for tuning in.